Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, it's Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman to talk about banned books on Forbes Avenue, and this is on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The reason I'm talking with Professor Newman about banned books is because you run a banned books class. So how did you end up offering that class?
I don't remember what the initial inspiration was. I think the original title was Censored Texts. But starting about 20, 25 years ago, I just got interested in the phenomenon, and I noticed that it was happening more and more. And then I got interested in the history of it. And every time you poke at a case of book banning, you find something different and you find something interesting. So I taught the class originally. I had like a set of texts that would change, and the students would write papers on what we were reading. And then 6 years ago, I changed to the format I have now, where students do original, in-depth, high-quality research on a single case of book banning. And I found that CMU students really rose to the occasion and did really good work. So I'm enjoying this new format.
What would you say you've learned from having this class?
It is so cool to see what students are interested in. I have students from all over the world, and so a lot of students want to work on books that were banned in their home country. So China, a student came up to me today and said she wanted to do a play that's been banned in Colombia. So I learn about books from all over the world. That's one super cool thing. And then I think students who choose books that have been banned more recently, I've helped students do things like find the video of the school board meeting where the book was banned. And so just getting to see human beings in action doing this thing that we kind of think of as nefarious or behind closed doors, like actually being able to see the school board meeting where it happened is really cool.
So you were talking about the trend that you noticed 25 years ago. Would you say that it still holds? Are we banning more books than we ever have?
I don't remember what I was inspired by 25 years ago exactly, but certainly since 2019, 2020, there has just been like a hockey stick graph. Like it is like right now, I would say is probably the most challenges in American history are happening to books right now. The group that really tracks that is PEN America. They come out with a report every 1 to 2 years. And so they're just showing that there's more and more parts of the country and more kinds of books and more different kinds of people who are challenging books. So I think I came up with the idea for this class, and now it's really more relevant than ever before.
So I know there's a lot of people trying to combat that with social media, online library cards, that kind of thing.
Yes. I think sometime in the last couple of years, maybe the Brooklyn Public Library made it possible for anybody in the country to get a library card there, and then they could get electronic books or audiobooks. So I think, I mean, here, this is one of the ironies. In some ways, information has never been more accessible, more available, cheaper. And so it kind of raises the question, why challenge a book if somebody can just get it some other way? What is the political capital that's being expended to say, I want this book out of this public library, or I want this book out of my kids' curriculum, or I want this book out of my kids' library? So I think the questions are in some ways more vexing now, because it just begs the question. And also, if you hand your 12-year-old a smartphone, why are you also trying to take a book out of that 12-year-old's classroom? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, although people on both sides of the political argument have decided to ban books for various reasons.
Definitely. There's not like one political group that has a monopoly on saying, I don't want my kid to read this book, or I don't want any kids to read this book. But there has been a more easy to track movement from American political conservatives since the Reagan era, and especially in the last 5 years. After Trump lost the 2020 election, there was an attempt by sort of the movement that was around Trump to attack school boards and to sort of take on cultural issues. And so critical race theory, books by diverse authors, books by queer authors, those books really started to come under attack kind of in the wake of that presidential loss.
So one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, beyond this being a great topic, is that we do have Banned Books Week coming up in late September. Do you feel like that celebration helps counteract this push towards book banning? Or does it possibly kind of not do enough?
Yeah, there's a real irony that's present in both book banning and book defending. Banned Books Week was the brainchild of a librarian from Pittsburgh. Her name was Judith Krug, and she was she worked for the American Library Association, and she went to the American Booksellers Association and said, you know, we're seeing this uptake in challenges. Why don't we band together and promote the idea that we should have the freedom to read? And so at a big book convention in 1982, there was the first kind of celebration or recognition of banned books. And there's been one every year since 1982. I think the irony is that every year when Banned Books Week comes around, somebody writes an article that says there's no such thing as a banned book in America. And it's true that it's incredibly rare that any governmental agency will ever take action against a book. We don't live in a totalitarian country where you could be jailed for what you write, at least not today. And so there's some irony that the presence of Banned Books Week tends to sort of incite opposition to the use of the term banned books and to the whole kind of, people say it's hysterical, it's sort of pearl clutching, it's much ado about nothing. At the same time, there's another ironic reaction, is that oftentimes when a book is targeted and then that target is publicized, that increases sales of the book. So the graphic novel Mouse was challenged by a Tennessee school board in January of 2022. And almost as soon as it was publicly known, that book just started flying off the shelves and they had to print some extra runs. So I think there's just irony on both sides. When you overtly try to defend books, you get attacked for sort of exaggerating the state of book banning. When you attack books, you often inadvertently promote them. There's an action and an opposite reaction that happens in both moves, both challenging and defending.
Given you've been studying banned books and teaching about them for so long, what would you say causes people to challenge them, especially when this causes such a counterswing to the other direction?
I mean, I think the positive that I see in book challenging is that it's a reminder, and a really happy reminder for me, because I'm an English professor, that books are powerful, that books incite strong emotions, that they make people want to do something, even if that thing is to close the book and try to take it away from other people. So I think it's evidence that in this kind of information saturated world, we still value books and we still find them to be life changing in a certain way. I think the other thing that I notice is that the internet and social media, I think, has allowed people to organize and exchange information at a much higher rate. So, for example, The Grapes of Wrath was banned by Kern County, California in 1939. And there was like a little 2-inch newspaper squib about it. And that newspaper Squibb got reprinted on a wire service, and so then a few other county libraries and city libraries took up the challenge and said, yes, we agree, we think Grapes of Wrath is offensive, and we're going to ban it. In some cases, there's one library that burned it. They had a ceremonial burning of it. So the newspaper was kind of the viral media of the day. Today, if somebody challenges a book, it's often part of a list that circulates through political groups. There's a conservative political group called Moms for Liberty that has chapters in different states. And then book defenders also are organized on state levels. So there's ACLU chapters in many, many American cities. So I think what I'm noticing is that in some ways, even though it's probably more futile to challenge a book than ever before, people can share information about what books to target and how to attack them. It's easier to share that information than it's ever been in the history of books.
Would you say that graphic novels, for example, you mentioned Mouse, are especially easy to target with this then?
Absolutely. I mean, graphic novels are targeted, you know, I don't remember what the percentage differential is, but it's at a much greater rate than books that just have words on the page. I do think there's a famous judge who said, I don't know what art is versus pornography, but I know it when I see it. So we somehow trust our eyes to tell us if something is offensive or bad or wrong. And that visual information, we believe that we can adjudicate it in a way that we somehow maybe don't feel like we can adjudicate the written word in the same way. So graphic novels are constantly under attack. Anne Frank is a frequently banned book, The Diary of Anne Frank, but the graphic novel of The Diary of Anne Frank, banned and challenged even more. Things having to do with the Holocaust, like Mouse, Diary of Anne Frank, those have really been hot button books in recent years. Other graphic novels that are under attack, genderqueer, coming of age memoir about a non-binary author. The most banned book in America, basically since the day it was published.
You mentioned that Holocaust and queer issues are a hot topic. Is there anything else that tends to be banned?
One of the people that we study in my class is one of the top banned book researchers in the U.S., and her name is Emily Knox. She teaches at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So she's just a fantastic scholar, and she has a wonderful article about how when books get challenged, it tends to be diverse books that get challenged. And what she means by diverse books is books by authors who are considered to have some kind of marginal identity in that moment or in some past historical moment. So books by women, books by African-American authors, books by queer authors, books by Native American authors, Asian-American, Indian-American, Latino-American, those books tend to be the most targeted. And Knox, I don't know if she would call herself a free speech absolutist, but she would really challenge anybody who wants to ban books, because her argument is ultimately when bans and challenges go forward, they tend to fall on the text written by more marginal authors more than any other kind of author. So you might think, oh, I don't want To Kill a Mockingbird taught because the author used the N-word. But then it turns out that most books that are banned for the use of the N-word are written by African-American authors. So you might think that you have the best intentions when you're trying to get a book out of circulation, but the end result is that the people who get silenced are the people that we really need to hear from the most.
Thank you so much. I'm Riona. I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman talking about banned books. So I wanted to situate banned books in the larger context of free speech. How do banned books and free speech go hand in hand, do you think?
I love that question because I always start the class with the First Amendment. And I think that when students hear the word free speech, and if they haven't had to do AP Gov or, you know, some really intensive civics course, you just think, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. And the First Amendment is 45 words, and not that many of those words are about free speech. And all it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. And that actually isn't very specific and doesn't actually give you the freedom to say whatever you want. It only says that Congress shall make no law. So I really like to think about how kind of weird those 45 words are and how limited they are in terms of what we know how to do with them. One thing that is really shocking to me right now is how many state legislatures are passing laws against books. And the 1619 Project has been banned by at least a dozen state legislatures across the country. So I haven't seen any of those cases go up to the Supreme Court, but I sort of can't believe that we are actually passing laws against books, even despite the First Amendment. And I don't know if a state legislature is, I guess, distinct from Congress, but I honestly just don't understand it, can't figure it out. But I think that the openness, the vagueness, maybe the simplicity of the First Amendment does give us a real opportunity to think about what it means to have free speech and what the American Library Association calls the freedom to read. The ALA has a Reader's Bill of Rights or Library Bill of Rights that I teach in the class, and I can't recite it chapter and verse, but the basic idea is that you have the freedom to receive information. And I think that is much more comprehensive than simply the idea that Congress shall pass no law. Because if I have the freedom to receive information, if you have the freedom to receive information, then we can't be prevented from accessing a book in the library that a librarian has deemed appropriate or reading a book in a class that a teacher has deemed appropriate. We are free to receive that information. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this political moment is that many people have perceived the conservative party, the Republican Party in America, to be the party of freedom, of liberty. I don't want big government. I don't want to be taxed. I don't want to be told that I can't own or carry a gun. But that movement of liberty and freedom, going into schools and saying, you can't have this book in my child's classroom or in my child's school, seems to be sort of going against this message of freedom that we've been hearing for a long time. So I do think this is an exciting moment to think about what freedom is, freedom to and freedom from. And I think in some ways, the freedom to receive information protects, if that was enshrined in our Constitution, it would protect us from the kinds of bans and challenges we're seeing so frequently right now.
Yeah, it's a really thorny issue, though, because even if Congress doesn't make any law or the government doesn't make any laws, there's still society which can kind of chill free speech. For example, cancel culture.
Yeah, I put cancel culture at the very end of the class and kind of save it for the last week because I find that 18 to 22-year-olds are pretty comfortable with the idea that we shouldn't be banning and challenging books, but are maybe more interested in canceling as a project. So I try to have us spend the whole semester looking critically at book banning and then thinking about what's the difference and what's the similarity. And I think I study the history of consumer activism, the history of boycotts. So I sort of put canceling a little bit more on the side of consumer culture. I don't want to read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, somebody might say. You know, then you have kind of extreme versions of that where people were destroying their Keurigs. sometime in the last few years, because I think Keurig had a progressive advertising message or but the idea, like, I'm not going to buy this product because of what the product represents or because of what the author did, and I don't agree with it. So I'm okay with consumer activism. I think it's fine. I do find that the accusation that somebody has been canceled tends to be overblown, in the sense that a lot of so-called canceled people still have their platforms. I do think it's really interesting when it crosses over into labor. So I think the case I'm thinking of is the case of Amy Cooper, who met an African-American man named Chris Cooper in Central Park. She had her dog with her in an area where you're not supposed to have dogs because it's a bird area. He said, could you please take your dog out of here so I can watch birds? And she videoed him saying that, and she threatened to, she actually did call the police and say, there's an African-American man threatening me in the Ramble. I think that was the name of the area of the park. She was fired from her job. Should people lose their jobs because they were caught being racist and idiotic on social media? I don't know. That's a hard question for me. You do not have free speech at work. 100%. And I think, again, people come into my class thinking, oh, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, wherever I want. Your employer can fire you for what you say. So I do get really interested in kind of the layers and contradictions that come out when you start thinking about the similarities and the differences between banned books and cancel culture.
Taking it back a little closer to banned books, people can also be fired for perhaps giving a child access to a book. So I feel like that also verges onto labor.
It does. Teachers and librarians are just under so much duress right now for being in the public eye around these issues. They are getting threatened with arrest, more kind of garden variety bullying, death threats, digital harassment, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA, organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn. Again, for, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a formula. We don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue, and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago. So originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective. Even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that, because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of, and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. It's lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and you're listening to From Here to Eternity, that show where we take a trip back to the 80s that you never knew. Well, today, we're going to just, you know, do the usual little mix of some things, but we're going to start off today with a song, because we're in spring right now. You know, I feel like, you know, in the spirit of the general springtime, you know, there really isn't any, I guess, Easter music. So we'll settle for spring. We're going to start off with this song here. It's excellent. I think it was entered into both Sanremo and Eurovision at the time. This is a tremendous song. Personal favorite I've had on loop for quite some time. This is Maledetta Primavera by Loretta Goggi. We're going to do that right now.
Stringersi poi, vino bianco, fiori e vecchie canzoni, e si rideva di noi, che imbroglio era nera che resta di un sogno erotico. Sei al risveglio è diventato un poeta, se a mani vuote di te non so più fare, come se non fosse amore, se per errore chiudo gli occhi e penso a te.
Ma la terza primavera che porta a sé per innamorarsi.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and you just heard Dream by P. Lion. For that, we had the Air Studio version of Tel Aviv, the one that I think should have made it to the album. That was by Duran Duran, and we started off today with Maledetta Primavera, and that was by our good friend from Italy. If I have her name, it slips. I always lose it. Loretta Goggi. There we go. But the next one, I wanted to at least play one song by them because I did see them. They were in town over here in D.C. Flock of Seagulls came, and great show. They ended up playing Space Age Love Song twice after the audience was like, yeah, play it again. So that was good, but we're going to do one that didn't get a crazy amount of attention, at least on the charts. This one's going to be The More You Live, The More You Love. I'm going to go into that right now. WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's DJ Tony Tunes, and right now we're listening to Pink Footpath by Lewis. For that, we had Ochi Brown's Whenever You Need Somebody. The original that was done by the legendary producer trio Stock, Aiken, and Waterman, for it was on the album for which it was titled by Rick Astley. For that, though, we had Unodo all'anima. That was another Italian song. That one was by Pamela Prati. For that, we had The More You Live, The More You Love by A Flock of Seagulls. But before we get back into things, just wanted to let you know a quick couple of things. Firstly, does your child sometimes get headaches, stomach aches when they aren't sick? Those headaches and stomach aches your child gets may be migraine. A migraine is not just a headache. A migraine attack can last for hours or even days, often with sensitivity to lights and sounds or nausea and vomiting. Migraine is more common than you think. 10% of children and 28% of adolescents have migraine disease.